This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Subscribe to the podcast Beyond Politics. They host some of the biggest names and smartest minds. Beyond Politics is from a former Democratic congressman who helped ignite Barack Obama's campaign and a former campaign manager and political columnist. They go beyond the usual chatter on politics, news, science, and books. It's politics and everything beyond. On Beyond Politics, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Broadcasting live on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, and in the evenings on WCPT 820 for Chicago's Progressive Talk. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Good to have you with us today. Matt and Patrick here. We're knee-deep in Taylor Swift love. How many times have you listened to the new album so far?
Have not had a chance to listen to it at all yet.
18 times already. Guess what? There's a breakup song on there. I don't know. I know that you're going to be surprised by that.
I can't believe that.
Coming up here in about a half an hour, Leanne Herzog-Donovan, who's a nurse, pediatric nurse at HCMC, Hennepin County Medical Center, and Dr. Andrew Wu, he's a pediatric ICU attending at HCMC, they are going to Rwanda to try to start the country's only second pediatric ICU unit. We're going to talk to them about that. What the goal is, the task ahead, because that's going to be huge, as well as also they need help getting out there, because as much as they want to go out and help these people, there's not a lot of money to help them. So we're going to give some addresses for you to go to possibly give them a hand, help them out a little bit later on. But I got to start off with what is the shocking story that happened outside of Donald Trump's trial here. A man set himself on fire Friday afternoon near the lower Manhattan courthouse where jurors were being chosen for the criminal trial of former President Trump. The man doused himself with an accelerant around 1:35 this afternoon in Collect Pond Park across the street from the courthouse. Onlookers screamed and started to run as soon as bright orange flames engulfed the man. It was unclear what motivated his action, but he threw leaflets espousing anti-government conspiracy theories into the air before the incident. I'll start there. It sounds like they've got an idea who this guy is. It sounds like this was, as you expect nowadays, a bunch of people screaming, Joe Biden's responsible. A bunch of people screaming, Donald Trump's responsible. Doesn't sound like the case. It sounds like this guy was just, you do not set yourself on fire unless you're mentally compromised. I'll get to that here in a little bit. But it sounds like this guy was swimming in an Olympic-sized swimming pool of conspiracy theories on a large variety of things. He clearly was not mentally well. People rushed to extinguish the fire, but the intensity of the heat could be felt several hundred feet away. After a few minutes, dozens of police officers arrived to smother the flames. The man was loaded into an ambulance, rushed away. He was alive. I do not recommend watching the videos. I'm going to just let you know, viewer be warned. And, I know Chicago, you're going to be getting this in the evening. Trust me, if you haven't seen him, don't go look at him. It's rough. The New York Fire Department said he was taken to a hospital in critical condition. The high-ranking police department official identified the man as Max Azzarello, Azzarello, of St. Augustine, Florida. The official requested anonymity because the man had not been publicly identified. Mr. Azzarello had appeared outside the courthouse on Thursday with a sign displaying the address of a website where the same pamphlets were uploaded. The top post on the website says, I have set myself on fire outside the Trump trial. People who witnessed the fire say they were in disbelief when they saw Mr. Azzarello, who was in the area of the park reserved for supporters of Mr. Trump, toss the pamphlets in the air and flames shooting towards the sky. Mr. Azzarello, who was wearing jeans and a dark gray T-shirt, fell to the ground after he was on fire for at least 20, 30 seconds and finally fell to the ground. Some of the pamphlets referred to the New York University as a mob front and also mentioned former President George W. Bush, former Vice President Al Gore, and the lawyer David Boies, who represented Mr. Gore in the 2000 presidential election. Another pamphlet contained anti-government conspiracy theories. Al Baker, a spokesman for the court system, said the trial schedule would not be affected, though one court officer had been taken to the hospital because of the effects of smoke inhalation. Fred Gates, 60, said he'd been riding his bike through the park when he stopped to watch the Trump supporters, saw Mr. Azzarello getting ready to light himself on fire. Mr. Gates said he thought it was a prank or a performance until he saw the flames. Another witness, Gideon Oliver, a civil rights lawyer, said he saw smoke rising from the park in the court and a court officer rushing from the building carrying a fire extinguisher. When I saw and smelt the smoke, I assumed one of the pro-Trump protesters had lit themselves in the park. When I saw the police and the court officers running, I thought it might have been a bomb, per se. Mr. Azzarello stood tall as he poured the accelerant over himself, then held a flame to his chest level. As the people nearest him fled, others cried out as they realized what he was about to do. Screams and shouts, though not from him, filled the ears. The flames consumed him, and he slowly collapsed. It is, once again, your warning, do not go watch this video. It's one of those things you do not have to. You want to watch. And in this day and age, if you have some ability to control it, I hope that your kids don't get to see it either. It's pretty rough to watch. Once again, I want to reiterate, from what I have seen on this individual in regards to some of the things, and once again, I want to give credit to the first person that seemed to identify this individual. This was Salman Ahmed, who posted on social media. He's an investigative journalist who identified Max Azzarello as the individual who had set himself on fire fairly early before and pretty much anyone else had. He shared a picture of one of the pamphlets here, and I can't say for sure if this is one. This is just an image. I will say my first thought was I was skeptical of this because it was so much ahead of everyone else, including the New York Times, who got a leak from the New York Police Department. But the fact that the guy actually identified the man way before anyone else gives it some credence. And I'm just going to read the pamphlet here, the true history of the world. Haunted Carnival Edition. We'll know our disinformation campaign is complete when everything the American public believes is false, says CIA Director Bill Casey, 1981. An Occupy Returns booklet. The only goal, abolish our criminal government and replace it with one that serves all. So basically, and it goes into, it seems like there has been other things where his conspiracy theories seem to be multifaceted. A sign allegedly that he was carrying in the park, Trump is with Biden and they're about to fascist coup us. It does not sound like this is a one side or the other situation. It sounds like this is, and once again, and I'm gonna take a few minutes here. All right. So when I was in the Army, one of the things that happens when you get to your platoon and stuff like this is you have to get someone trained as the emergency medic. Okay, that's just something that happens. God forbid the medic gets killed or the medic is injured themselves. Someone needs to do things, and I had to go through the emergency medic program in the military. I still, to this date, if I can still apologize to my fellow veteran Kelly Sewell, who he was a great guy from Mississippi, and I had to put an IV in him, and he's a good man. I had to go do that. I had to go do everything, and the first thing that they tell you is to evaluate. Are they breathing? Are their heartbeat? Sort of things. You got to get, you know, obviously some concerns there. There are two things you have to be on the lookout for that are very dangerous in regards to the, you know, whether or not at this point, and once again, the training I took at that time getting the soldier off the field and into a medical unit evaluating it. One was shock, and I was actually surprised at how damaging shock is to the body. It is something you've got to be very careful with, and if someone's in shock, you need to get them into a medical unit very quickly. Burns, if someone is burned and burned badly, like this individual is clearly burned very badly, I'm going to guess, if not 100%, 95 or more percent of his body's got third-degree burns on it. Your body does an interesting thing, and once again, for the medical people, I know I'm not doing it justice. I'm just giving the basic thing, but you're basically, your body goes into survival mode because it's constantly in pain with the burns, and it's trying to heal itself, and it will start shutting down parts of your body to try to keep other parts of the body going, and it does not go well. And there is many cases where people go into a hospital alive having extreme burn situations and pass away in the next, you know, 10 to 12 hours because the damage has been done. It happens that way. I don't know if there is no word on the status of this individual, his case, what is going on. What I can say is that I would not be surprised if he does pass away from these burns, because that is an unbelievable amount of damage that he has done to his body. And I think we need to also, once again, understand there are people, and trust me, I have run into them in my business, that they become so immersed in conspiracy theories that they don't want to see reality anymore. That they become convinced that everything is a conspiracy theory. That, you know, fallout on Amazon is a conspiracy theory. That the asparagus being on sale at the grocery store is a conspiracy theory. That sort of level. You get to the point where you are contemplating doing what this individual has done. They're so mentally compromised. That's the only way you could do something of this nature. It is truly horrific. It is unfortunate. It obviously caught a lot of people off guard. There's a CNN clip where the host on the scene was there, and very quickly, first she thought it was shots fired. Then she realized, no, it's someone's on fire. And they did the best that they could to relay the news as it was. But obviously, once again, I want to take the quick moment here, because as we are in this world, a lot of people on the right are screaming, Joe Biden. A lot of people on the left are saying, Donald Trump. The reality is, from all accounts so far of this individual, this guy was equally condemning of both sides. And it seems like, and once again, we are talking about something that he clearly was mentally compromised to even think about doing something of this nature. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on your Friday. We've been standing in the same room. People talking, but I don't want. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. Good to be with you tonight. Having a good night out in Chicago. I hope you're doing well out there. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I'll figure out the phone number eventually. It's only been 14 years. I wanted to, obviously, that I think was the lead story of today. But I did want to take some time to talk as well about the Trump trial. Jury selection in the former President Trump's New York criminal hush money trial concluded today, with all 18 New Yorkers who will make up the jury panel seated. Opening statements are now on track to begin in the first ever criminal trial for a U.S. president. The 18 jurors, which includes six alternates, were impaneled after days of intense scrutiny by the lawmakers on both sides to find citizens who can be as fair as possible in one of the most high-profile cases in U.S. history. Lawyers scoured prospective jurors' social media to try to get an insight into their underlying political beliefs and any possible motives for being on the trial, One prospective juror, for instance, was dismissed by Trump's legal team over a 2017 post about the president that said, lock him up. Well, I definitely would have been kicked off this jury pool. Given the high-profile nature of the case, there are still a few bumps in the process. One juror, for instance, was excused after she expressed concerns over being identified. Another juror was dismissed after prosecutors expressed concern about whether he answered questions about his criminal history, honestly. As part of the opening statements, attorneys from both sides will present their theories of the case and preview the evidence they are likely to show. Judge Juan Merchan, who is overseeing the trial, has said that he expects at least 6 to 8 weeks on this. It is clear that Trump, with his lawyers, are already in trouble. Now, I don't think it's too hard to understand. Trump's not exactly getting the A-list lawyers at this point. He's not getting the top-of-the-line lawyers. He's just not. He is basically set. If you think about what he has done to lawyers and the destruction of the judicial career that he has done to these lawyers, I got to believe even if I was a supporter of Trump, I wouldn't want anything to do with being Trump's lawyer. Not in the least bit. He also, because he is a petulant man-child, and he is, this is literally a kid who never had their parents tell them no, who thinks he's so much smarter than everyone else, thinks that they know how everything, he is the narcissist of most narcissists. He is basically a man who has never really been held accountable. And when he was finally held accountable in 2020, he decided that he would, to prove that he was right, overthrow the government of the country himself, including encouraging the mob to hang his own vice president. That is the epitome of a sore loser. In the history of the world, there are sore losers, and then there's Donald Trump. And he has already made this trial a nightmare for his lawyers there, with all of his antics and his behavior so far. He's definitely not got the judge on his side. But there's also, I don't know if he didn't understand this or if his lawyers didn't, or a combo platter. So when you are choosing a jury, we've had Jack Rice on from Court TV a few times to talk about legal issues, and he's talked about, strikes that when you're doing jury selection, you do get a certain amount of strikes awarded by the judge that you can negate a potential juror from without any question. Here it is. Strike. Done. They're gone. For some reason, Donald Trump was not aware he had a finite amount of strikes, that he thought he could basically eliminate anyone forever in this trial. And by the way, the reason why this exists is because I think what was Jack said is a case there a long time ago where basically the guy held off his trial by basically sitting there and constantly putting strikes out and saying we can't even seat a jury. So they have rules about this, that you have a certain amount of leeway with jurors, and this is the case. They said it in the trial that there is a certain amount of strikes that each side gets. They're very clear about that, and Trump still is somewhat baffled by the fact that he could not, after he burned off his first 15 really quick, he couldn't negate other people from the jury. So, yeah, it's also, by the way, this is taking a toll on him. This really actually is taking a toll on him. Reacting to an angry rant delivered by Trump when he showed up to court on Friday morning, CNN legal analyst Ellie Hung noted the former president looked frazzled, which could be due to the prosecutors that are getting at him after only 3 days in court. Oh, I think him having to sit in a courtroom is killing him. He does not want to do this. He does not want to be here. She said that Trump seemed to be agitated as he addressed the press and listened to a series of grievances. From watching how Donald Trump was in speaking to reporters before he went in, he was definitely at least projecting that he was angry and frustrated. He's definitely looking frazzled. I think that's a good word we can use for this. It then goes on, Maggie Haberman from the New York Times noted once again that Donald Trump, he has been in court 4 days. He fell asleep again today. Trump dozed off during a hearing related to his hush money trial today on Friday. In an updated post from the New York Times live blog, Haberman wrote that Trump appears to have fallen asleep in court again, and he then added, it happened several times just now as his eyes were closed in extended periods and his head dropped down twice. Haberman also had some observations about Trump's appearance as he entered the court on Friday. His hair is uncharacteristically messy, like the wind hit it on the way into court. He looks like this is killing him. This is killing him, actually being held accountable. Once again, this is a guy who does not want to be held accountable, ever. I would be remiss if I did not bring up, though, one thing which seems to be Donald Trump, apparently, and Hal Sparks joked about this, that is going to be brutal. Apparently, this is a report from credible sources from someone posted on Twitter. So, yeah, whatever. I'm hearing credible sources that Trump is actually passing gas in the courtroom. I'm hearing from actual credible people that he's kind of falling asleep. He's actually passing a gas, and that his lawyers are really struggling with him passing the gas. Now, I am a 55-year-old man. I have done some elderly things. The time I screwed up my Desidin with my Sensodyne, delightful. Anyway, and not on the toothbrush, mind you. Anyway, as I get older in age, there are certain things I don't do anymore, and one of them is I don't eat fast food because that plays havoc with me. And I'm 23 years younger than Donald Trump, and that dude eats fast food all the time. I have zero doubt that's the USS Hindenburg over there. I'm surprised he's not floating around the courtroom, if you want to know the truth, frankly. All right, we'll take a break. Come on back. When we do return, we're going to be talking about how we can help out people of Rwanda with some needed medical help. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I'm surviving. In the evenings on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk and in the afternoons on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. Good to have you with us. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Leanne Herzog-Donovan, I've known her for years. She is a pediatric ICU nurse at HCMC. I saw her about 2 weeks ago, and she was telling me about a project that she is involved with trying to help out the people of Rwanda. And so I said, I got to have you come on the air, especially when I found out that the funding to get there and do this really good work is not easy to come by. So I want to try to help out with that. And she is kind enough to not only come join us on the show, but she's being joined by Dr. Andrew Wu. He's a pediatric ICU attending at HCMC, Hennepin County Medical Center here in Minneapolis, St. Paul as well. And they're both kind enough today to join us to talk about the initiative that they're going through in Rwanda. Hi, thank you very much. I appreciate the time, guys.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. So, Leanne, let's start. You and I were talking. Rwanda apparently only has one pediatric ICU unit. Is that the case over there?
Yeah. So, I was trying to find out exactly how many pediatric hospitals or hospitals that had pediatrics, inside of their hospitals. And I don't know, Andrew, do you know how many? I think I saw like four hospitals, but I'm pretty sure there's only one that has ICU capabilities.
Yeah, so there's four kind of higher resource hospitals in Rwanda. Three of them are in the capital, Kigali, and one of them's up in Butaro, which is the hospital that we're working with. And the hospital that we're working with in Butaro is just starting their ICU, so that's what we're getting involved with. There are kind of ICU-level care. There is ICU-level care for pediatrics, I think, in Kigali and one or two of their hospitals, but I think that's about it. There is pediatric care outside of those hospitals, but they are more of kind of like There are fewer resource facilities and they're kind of more clinics as opposed to larger hospitals.
This is a very eye-opening thing, and people complain about what things we have here. It, just off the top of your head, and I don't know if you know this, doctor, how many pediatric ICU units are there in Minneapolis-St. Paul? How many hospitals have one?
Oh, gosh. Well, so there's one at the university, there's one at HCMC. Children's has one in each site, so at least there's four right there.
Gillette.
And that's just within, what's that?
Gillette.
And then Gillette too, so you have five. And then our ICU beds, you know, usually per unit, there's at least like, Hennepin has nine and, you know, the U has close to 20.
Yeah.
Whereas the ICU we're working with has four.
Yes.
And those are going to adults and kids. So it's not just kids. So really it's kind of, you know, two if you want to divide even.
And I want to put it in perspective for people out there. The Chicago as well. I'm presuming you have at least 10 of these units in your fine metro area. Rwanda is a country of 13 million people, I believe it is. And they have one pediatric ICU unit. And this is the one you're working with right now. You're trying to get up and going. Not only it has only four beds, and it's also dealing with adults. So it's kind of one of those things where to say that there's a need is probably one of the largest understatements you could say. I mean, it's basically for the size of the population, it's pretty much almost a non-existent option.
And to add to that, Matt, there is one formally trained pediatric ICU doctor in the whole country.
In the entire country?
In the whole country. He wasn't even trained in Rwanda. He was actually trained, I'm going to feel bad if I say this wrong, but I believe in Kenya, one of the neighboring sub-Saharan African countries.
How did you guys hear about this? How did you hear about this complete lack of basic care within a country?
What, Leanne, do you want me to start since I kind of got you in or?
Yeah, because so Dave was kind of telling me a little bit about it before. I can start and then you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, for sure.
But so there's an organization called Global Perm NW, and they have done outreach in Ethiopia, and they started making some connections with Rwanda, and I guess through who they were speaking with there, they found out that there was a need also for pediatrics. Well, the physician that I'm speaking of from Global Perm, he is adult only medical ICU. And so he didn't know anybody at all in pediatrics. So he reached out to one of his colleagues, and that colleague had just recently moved to Minnesota and works at the University of Minnesota. So that person reached out to the pediatric ICU attending and I think medical director at the university, Gwen, and she got in contact with Andrew. And then Andrew asked our nurse manager if there was anyone that wanted to help.
How many people total are planning on going over there right now?
From our group,
yeah,
or total?
Yeah, from your group.
So two nurses and two physicians from our group.
All right. Yeah. And I have to imagine, I mean, you are working in a fairly advanced medical environment here. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about your choice to kind of throw yourself into a world where you basically it's building a unit as you're going here. I mean, that's got to be, I mean, it, to a point, it must be extremely exciting, but at the same time, it's very intimidating.
Yes. Extremely intimidating. I will say what is helpful is that I've actually been to the hospital before. Mm-hmm. The hospital works closely with a university also in the same town, Butaro, called the University of Global Health Equity, which has been built up by many international partners. One of the major international players that helped build up that university is basically Harvard Medical School. And I was fortunate enough to go to part of my training was over there. Was over within the Harvard program. And so that's how I got to know the Rwanda site before. So all that to say is that a couple of years ago, I was actually at that site. So that kind of helps as well. But yes, you bring up a good point, is that it's a quite a daunting task. And in that country within their system, it's relatively, I shouldn't say unprecedented, but within their country and within that system, it's something new, right? It's going to be a new sort of environment that we're going to be exploring. But there's a lot of people who want to help out. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's really nice that Dave has kind of paved a way from Global Perm. Their team has kind of paved a way for the adult side. So really on the ped side, I feel like we have the easy job where we just kind of see what they're doing and then make the pediatric version of it. Mm-hmm. But really obviously we're partners and moving forward together on it too. So.
Leanne, as a nurse, one of the things that you and I were talking about is there's an entirely different mentality you have to take when you get there. That what you take for granted when you have a cart, when you have the instructions, all these things, that you have to be prepared that basically this is going to, you know, it is a building from scratch sort of thing. And even things such as basic manuals are going to be difficult to make sure that you have stocked and they're ready to go there, correct?
Correct. So we have been working for many months on creating policies and writing education for them. We don't know exactly what they have until we get there. So, for example, we're going to be teaching them a lot of skills that they're going to need to know how to do. And something as simple as placing an IV, putting a Foley catheter in somebody. And then, you know, it could be up to like intubating patients. So there's a wide range of things that they don't know how to do. Also, over there, they have pharmacists to a certain extent, but we're going to have to be teaching them how to mix up medications, mm-hmm. And teaching them how to use IV pumps because they don't currently use IV pumps on the regular ward, is what I was just on a call before I hopped on this call, and I just learned that. So I'm going to be helping teach them how to use the IV pumps, but we're also having skills sessions where we are teaching them how to mix up the drugs and make sure that they're double checking it with someone so that they're not doing it incorrectly and accidentally harming somebody. It's a wide, wide range of things and skills that we have to teach them. They also don't have respiratory therapists there. So the nurse is going to be in charge of setting up the ventilators and running the ventilators and doing everything. So the nurse there is actually, you know, even formula, they have to mix up formula. So they're, you know, nutrition, they're the nurse, they're the respiratory therapist. They're kind of running everything. And so for a hospital who has not ever had an ICU setting, this is quite a lot of information that we're going to have to be teaching them. And we are going to be making more trips in the future, like following up. So we're not just going one time and teaching, we are following up. And through the university, they also have set up a course where the people from Portland have been conversing with, I'll call them students, but the nurses over there, and kind of getting feedback on different materials that they've been sending them to read and their clinical experiences that they're having there. So I've been helping a little bit with that too.
This is something, and doctor, I'll have you chime in on this. We live in a comfortable world, and there's a tendency for us to not want to look past our own borders here, even just in our metro areas, and say, hey, we're fine here. I don't have to worry about this. The reality is that we have a lot of the world that we need to play catch up on and get to the level of basic medical care that they deserve, they have a right to. And, you know, talk a little bit about this, because, I mean, I think for a lot of people, this is probably the first time they're hearing, wait a second, there's one ICU, pediatric ICU unit in Rwanda? That doesn't make that sense. Of course we need to do better here. Talk about this, because I think there's an element of addressing this issue that needs to, you know, we obviously need to come to grips with here, too.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to pediatric health, so just child health in general, so kids die from all over the world due to various things. But if you look at the causes of death in kids under five, this is data that's been in the literature and the research for like a decade or two. A lot of those deaths come from preventable things. So pneumonia, diarrhea, things that we have antibiotics, medicines for, things where if nutrition was better, we would be able to prevent a lot of these deaths in these young kids. And a lot of these deaths are also due to poor prenatal care. So a lot of them are things that we can address, but by we, I mean kind of higher resource settings, right? And so if you look at where these deaths occur, they're mostly happening in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, predominantly in places where there are lower resources. And so a lot of people, you know, if you talk to people who do this sort of work as part of their career, right, where they go to lower resource settings and try to help out and from a health perspective, health and medicine perspective, there's a lot of different reasons why people go. And I think, Matt, I'm really glad you brought up this question, because I think there are, and I'm just speaking for myself, but I do think there are wrong reasons and right reasons for going. Mm-hmm. Historically, there's been this, the reason for going has been kind of like a, almost like a savior syndrome that people have, where they kind of come in, they help out, and then they leave. And then it's, and then over time, unfortunately, these lower resource settings become really dependent on these higher resourced folks. And then it's even to the point where it just kind of broaches like a colonialist sort of approach. Sorry, I'm kind of digressing a little bit, but basically to get to your question, yes, there is a big need for this. And I'm hoping that as people kind of look into this more, or if they're interested in it, that they're more interested in kind of building up the capacity that's there and empowering the people that are there. And then giving them the tools that they need to really kind of like help their own people.
Leanne, what's the, we got about 30 seconds here. What is the website? If people want to make a donation to help you guys get over there, where do they do that at?
It's globalpermnw.org. So globalpermnw.org.
I'll make sure I link to everything a little bit later on. Look for the links on social media and make a donation to help out, because obviously these guys are going over there and doing a lot of good work and starting a very good process, but it's expensive and it's a lot of it's out of pocket. So let's try to get as much money as we can to help these guys out. Leanne Herzog Donovan and Dr. Andrew Wu, all my best. Travel safe. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you so much.
Take care. We'll take a break. Come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. And by the way, Dr. Wu and his comment there, which I thought is it's that white knight stuff, that white savior stuff that, you know, thank God we're here. And what it does is it's basically just kind of going in there, dumping a lot of, you know, equipment and stuff, but not really training, not looking at the long-term health of the hospital, of the unit, acting like you've done something and leaving, and then realizing that there's a lot of problems. And I think that what they're doing, it sounds like it's a multi-level task. And this is just one country. And trust me, there are so many countries. We need to get out there. And we have the wealth. We have the money. We have the knowledge. We have the manpower. We just got to use it, man. And yeah, we are a global world. It blows my mind that a country of 13 million people only has, they got these four pediatric ICU beds going at this one hospital, but they're being used for adults as well as kids. And I think, what do you say, six at the other? 10 total pediatric ICU units. That's crazy. That is crazy. The website here, I got the website here, global, it's globalnw.org. Globalnw.org is the website, and I'll make sure I get out there and make a donation and help them out if you can. Because obviously there is that need. Some other breaking news from today I want to make sure I mention. The U.S. Department of Education on Friday announced the final rule that will update the Title IX regulations governing how schools respond to sexual misconduct, undoing changes made under the Trump administration and former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. For more than 50 years, Title IX has promised an equal opportunity to learn and thrive in our nation's schools, free from sex discrimination, said Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. And with a call to reporters on Thursday, these final regulations built on the legacy of Title IX will be clarifying that all nation students can access schools that are safe, welcoming, and respect their rights. This new rule will not roll back the Title IX changes. Will roll back the Title IX changes overseen by DeVos. Those regulations narrowly defined sexual harassment and directed schools to conduct live hearings to allow those who are accused of sexual harassment and assault to cross-examine their accusers. So I want to make, there are a lot of people on the right today who are acting as if this decision is destroying women. No. They changed the rules so that the rapists had the power even after the victims came forward. And that was an abomination. And I'll tell you what, I that is one thing I cannot stand. I cannot stand a system where that re-victimizes the victims. And we have this happen way too much. And so, and we forget that. That was DeVos. DeVos went out there and said, well, I don't think the guy from the frat house who's on the lacrosse team should basically be punished for life just because he got a little frisky. You know, that was the mentality. And as crazy as it sounds, and by the way, we forget how insane the Trump's term was. Because that happened, and it's hardly even a speed bump. But once again, his administration came on out and said, if you were a dude that basically decided to assault a girl, don't worry, you get to put her on the stand and cross-examine her and call her a slut to her face. And that was what they thought was equal rights for women, to basically make sure they could be re-victimized by their male abusers. Unbelievable. Many advocates argue the practice could discourage victims and sexual misconduct from coming forward as designed. Of course it did. Trump was looking at the frat boys and saying, hey, you know, and you guys, I don't want you guys getting in trouble. And that's why this was done. This was done to protect the people, the abusers. Oh, God. Biden, during his campaign in 2020, promised to nix the Trump administration's Title IX regulations. The final rule will protect students and employees from sex-based discrimination, such as sexual violence and other forms of sex-based harassment. It also requires schools to have in place measures to offer support for those who make complaints. The rules also set guidelines for schools, such as treating all forms of sexual discrimination complaints equally and promptly. The new rule codifies protections for transgender students from sex discrimination. It prohibits discrimination against the LGBTQ students and employees based on their sexual orientation, gender identity, and sexual characteristics. The final regulations clarify that a school must not separate or treat people differently based on the sex in a manner that subjects them to more than de minimis harm except in the limited circumstances permitted in Title IX. The final regulations further recognize that preventing someone from participating in school in separate sex activities, consent with their gender identity, causes that person more than de minimis harm. So as you can see, the conservatives have all focused on this. They're going to let men walk in and stare at your daughters in the changing room. Mind you, they seem to be perfectly fine with rapists being able to re-victimize their victims in their sham trial scenarios. That was okay, because dude gets a few beers in him, man. Dude, man, just because I got a few beers in me, now all of a sudden you don't want it? Oh, come on, man. God, we are living in the dumbest age. I mean, seriously, the dumbest age. The rule does not establish no criteria for transgender athletes, which is a separate rule the Department of Education is still finalizing. A senior administration official said that rule would prevent blanket bans on transgender athletes. Mind you, and I want to make sure we repeat this and repeat this often, as Republicans get back to this, so guys are going to be basically put on a dress and then they get to go in the girls' locker room. Mind you, as they threaten this, there's a whole bunch of people out there abusing women, children, kids, girls, not drag queens, not the transgender population. Not at all. As a matter of fact, what was it, 700 cases of child sex abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention? That whole group of churches, like 700 cases of child abuse. Well, something like that. It was a story out of the Houston Chronicle. Not drag queens, not transgender, but heaven forbid. And you see, and here's the problem. I mean, this is the thing I've always said. How many times do these people who obsess about the transgender population ignore clear and obvious abuse that's happening right in front of their faces, but because the villain isn't the villain of their choice, they ignore it? Exactly. Chicago, love you. Have a great weekend. Minneapolis, St. Paul, hour two up next. Hour number two of the show here on your Friday. Good to be with you. Matt and Patrick here. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I hope you have a good weekend planned here. I've got, I'm going to go over to the Guthrie. I got tickets to go see some of those Shakespearean plays I got going on over there. It's Record Store Day tomorrow, which is awesome. They're already lining up over at Electric Fetus. Have you ever lined up for an album?
I have not.
I kind of want to do it, but I'm so busy tomorrow, I can't do it. Electric Fetus, Cheapo Records down in the Valley, they're all going to have that stuff. I imagine Twin Tone down in Hopkins will have some stuff as well. Also Saturday, it's 420. Get your dope on. Legal here in Minnesota. Anyway, activities include Cannabus, which chauffeurs riders to six 420 celebrations in the Twin Cities. I hope there's some hammocks on that bus. Grounded Garden stand-up comedy show. I'm going to guess it's going to just be a lot of giggling. An immersive wellness experience at the Hemp Store at Cannajoy and part of the St. Paul Cannabis Bar Pot Shots. Prices vary. Enjoy responsibly. I am not about to do any dope before I go to the Shakespearean show. I think I'll run in fear. Anyway, one other thing that kicks off this weekend is the Minnesota Timberwolves are in the playoffs with a home series against the Phoenix Suns. They are the 3 seed. Joining us right now, not only is our expert in COVID and all the diseases, but he's also a huge T-Wolves fan who does, and I think it's one of the best things about T-Wolves games, he texts me during the game about what's going on. Dr. Joe Eastman is kind enough to join us to get you not into COVID worry at this point. We're just going to talk about the T-Wolves. We can worry about them because I'm very concerned about this matchup. Dr. Joe, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Oh, thanks for having me on. My pleasure. I'm nervous as hell right now.
So. Well, one of the things, Dr. Joe, you and I imagine are the same. Last weekend, they had an inferior Phoenix team at home. If they win, they've got two rounds of the playoffs at home. They would not be facing off against Phoenix. They would get one of the play-in game teams. Instead, they do what this team does often, which is sit on the sidelines and think to themselves, the other teams are going to allow us to win. And by the time halfway, this is the second period, a second quarter, when they realized, oh, this team's playing to win, it was too late. And by the time they got to an end, they never really got into that game because they basically didn't try until the game was already out of hand.
They've done that down the stretch here, and it's particularly worrisome. But I heard Rudy interviewed earlier, and it sounds like these guys are really, really down to business and ready to get rolling. My daughter, the last Timberwolves game she went to was, I think it was almost 2 years ago, and it was against Phoenix, and that's the last time we beat them. But I'll throw a caveat on there. All their starters were hurt. So right now you got a Phoenix team that is completely healthy, the best shape they've been in all year. So it's a little concerning. And, remember, the game starts at 2:30 tomorrow, too. So we don't have our usual nighttime viewing. But
Before you text me, I'm going to be over watching Henry IV over at the Guthrie. I cannot respond while you are texting me about this. Just, I want to give you that heads up now, okay? Right. You can text me. I mean, you can text me. I actually want you to text me so I can read through this, especially if it goes south on us. So once again, because we skipped past one thing. What's our record against Phoenix this season?
Yeah.
0-3, right?
It's an offer, yep. it's really, like you say, the last two times we played them, we got down so far early and we just struggling to get back in the game, and we could never get over the hump. So we can't do that anymore.
Clearly
get business right away.
They clearly can't. Is there a worse team that the T-Wolves could match up against this entire playoffs? I mean, I guess the Celtics might be a pretty brutal matchup if it comes to the end of it, but I can't think of any other team that the Timberwolves match up against so poorly than Phoenix. And it's leading me to, and I'm going to say this, and I know that this is going to hurt, man, but I'm saying Phoenix in five. I think they're going to just kind of walk away with this, because I just don't think this T-Wolves team takes it seriously.
Yeah. I you know, and the common sense side of me says you're right. Because just the way they play defense against us and their offense, how they spread things out, and they got all these great shooters from the outside, you know, even Durant, 7 foot, you know, the guy's like a point guard in many ways. It's a horrible matchup. It really is. The one thing we can do, I think we got to do more of, is just hammer that ball inside and see where it goes from there. Get their big guy in foul trouble as quick as we can, and then we might have a fighting chance. But I'm pretty nervous.
Gobert is the defensive player of the year. He's doing everything he can, and even getting physical. I mean, he's doing what you need to do in the NBA as a great defender. He's been fantastic. Kat is just coming back. I know that there are some questions about whether he's going to merge. So the question comes down to Ant and Anthony Edwards. He is undeniably the next big superstar, but only if he stops this mentality that he doesn't have to play the game the entire time. He has a really, really bad habit of kind of, you know, just not really putting the effort in, especially early in games. And that's what, I mean, the difference between some guy like Ant and you know, name the, you know, Steph Curry or, you know, any of the great players. I mean, LeBron over the last few years, is those guys are looking to put the dagger into their opponent in the first quarter if they can. And Ant just doesn't seem to have that fire in him yet.
Yeah, I know what you mean, especially down the stretch. He hasn't showed up until like the third or fourth quarter in a lot of these games. He's also, has a tendency to take some just boneheaded shots I just cringe when he comes right down and stops at the 3-point line and fires one up. I just, oh no. And he hasn't been shooting very well. You know, you wonder how much that finger that he dislocated is affecting him. I don't think his dribbling even has been as clean as it used to be since that injury. So, you know, you don't know what's really going on in the guy physically sometimes. And I think he's going to come out with some pretty good juice right away, though. So,
well, you and I both know the deal, man. You drive the paint, you get them to where they have to put a defender or two defenders on Ant in the paint every time. That means, yeah, not only you, but the rest of the team is going to get 3-point options, or at least, you know, 15-foot shot options, and you know, you take them. I mean, you scare them into having to defend the hoop, and then basically take advantage of them when they consolidate their defense.
I think we'll see a concerted effort that we're going to go that direction. I really do, because when we would come back against them in the last couple of times we played them, it was. And that's what triggered it, was guys driving to the hoop and with total disregard, just go in there and get it done, you know. And it's, that's how we can beat these guys. And This is a horrible matchup.
It's like we play tomorrow. Oh God, they're gonna lose. But I will say, if we do win, we're gonna get the winner of the Lakers and Denver. And frankly, neither one of those teams scares me at all. I mean, we can beat Denver in Denver. You know, as a matter of fact, of Denver or OKC, I'd rather face off against Denver. I'm not too concerned about OKC. This all comes down to one thing. You and I, during the season, when Cat was healthy, when Gobert was healthy, when you had those two power leaders, and then you had Nas coming in off the bench, and you had three guys that could control that game, there was nothing, no team could stop the Timberwolves, because you had such size and power in the paint that, you know, it left guys wide open for the three-pointers, but they didn't need it because no one could stop them. If Gobert was being blocked, he'd pass it to Cat. If Cat was being blocked, he'd throw it to Nas. You know, if you get that two-man, you know, detail in the middle, we should win this and win this pretty handily.
Yeah, they're just getting their chemistry back, and I saw glimmers of it there the last couple of games that Cat did play. So you're absolutely right. During the season, when they were all in top-notch shape and everything, we were a machine. We should have even beat the Celtics on their home court,
yes,
giving them their first loss in a long time. I mean, I remember texting you, this is a bar fight.
You were. Watch this. We're gonna, they're like, all right. So I'm saying, all right, I would love for our little rainbows and puppy dogs fest here to basically to convince me. I still am Suns in five. I just, you know, this is a team. It's one of those things where it's a team that's in their head. And if they win this first game tomorrow, if they win this first game with dominance, this is not gonna, they'll win this series fairly quickly. But if they don't win that game, the best they can hope for is to go to the seven and hope that they can get out of it.
Yeah, we got to figure out a way to shut down that darn Bradley Beal. Oh, my gosh. That guy is so frustrating against us. It's like, what gets into, you know, certain people, like when we'd play the Bulls at Caruso, and, you know, just some weird guy that's not usually a big-time scorer. All of a sudden, he plays the Timberwolves, and he can't mess. And, you know, Booker and Durant, of course, they're top-notch, too, so... Yeah, we definitely got to come out swinging right away and put a stamp on that first game. It's crucial.
It's going to be
beat our first game. We're done.
I might screen grab your text messages to me when I come out of the Guthrie, and might screen grab them and share them with everyone. Like, because it will tell me everything about how this game is going. It will. All right. I guess really quick, are we doomed on the? How many diseases right now are ravaging the population? I mean, is it really kind of? Should we just focus on the Timberwolves and move ahead? And we'll have you on next week.
Yeah, that sounds good. Because I got a lot of things that I could catch people up on. And just last night, stuff was happening as I'm in a space talking to all these long haulers, and the WHO is all of a sudden extremely worried about the avian flu and human to human possible transmission firing up. And there was a weird thing in Argentina there where over 50 people came down with this really mysterious pneumonia-like virus, and it's not COVID, and they're not even sure what it is. And these people are in bad shape. I mean, ICU. By the way, thanks for having the doctor and the nurse on. That was great.
Well, my pleasure, man. I'll tell you what, that all sounds so positive and rosy. I can't wait to talk next week about all my, oh my God. All right. We're sending people into it, the positive weekend. All right. Dr. Joe, here's us. We'll put our hands together. We'll just hope that tomorrow goes the way we want to. And if it does, I think we'll look pretty good. You get 1-2 under your belt, and then this is going to be over fairly quickly. We'll keep positive on that level.
And I'll try to self-censor my text to you.
All right. Dr. Joe Eastman, not only our COVID and communicable disease expert, also our T-Wolves expert. All my best. I'll talk to you soon. Okay, Dr. Joe?
All right. You have a wonderful weekend. Thank you, Matt.
Take care. We'll take a break. Come on back. I think we're going to have Philip Anthony join us when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. It's like an old Mike Donahue show. It's like we got surprise guests all over the place. Philip Anthony from the Downright Upright Show is kind enough to join us right now. Hello, Philip. How are we?
Oh, my God. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing well, man. It was great to see you last weekend with Sexy Liberal.
I know. We had such a great time. I mean, you were great on stage. You look fabulous.
Well, thank you very much. It did help dramatically. As opposed to when I did the State Theater, I could see the audience. Not a big fan. I couldn't see really anyone. It was pitch black right off the stage. So, yeah, that did help my abilities.
Well, I have some exciting news. I had to come on and talk to your guests, your audience about it. So tomorrow on my show, I'm going to have someone who goes into prisons. She's called the Prison Lady. Phyllis Taylor is her name. She's well known throughout the world about this. She goes into prisons to rehabilitate prisoners so that when they come out, they are productive in society. So she's amazing to do that. And then next week, I'm going to do a rebroadcast of the interview I had with you.
Oh,
if you remember that.
I do remember that. That would be very, very nice of you. So talk about what's her, just a little bit background on this woman going into the prisons and helping to reform. What is her approach? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I don't want to give too much away.
Sure.
I keep the audience in suspense, but she was at an Oprah Winfrey event in Toronto. And, just as an audience member, and they had these women on the screens, and they were prisoners, and she saw the humanity in them, I guess. And she says, I have to do something. It was like she had an epiphany, and she left her law practice and went into prison. She called prisons, and she went in there and tried to rehabilitate these people.
Wow.
And she talks about her experiences. It's amazing. It really is.
All right. So this is the Downright Upright Show with Philip Anthony. It's 5 p.m. tomorrow. So even after the Timberwolves lose, it'll be done time for you to listen to Philip Anthony. And once again, that's going to be that sounds fascinating. That's going to be a good listen. So congratulations. Any other fun plans this weekend?
Well, I wanted to say one more thing about my show. So
sure.
Every first Saturday of the month, I have a co-host show, and it's 100% politics and current events. I do kind of what you're doing, and we're going to be talking about the abortion ruling by the Supreme Court in Arizona. We're going to be talking about foreign aid. Being passed today by the Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan aid, the jury being selected. We're going to be talking about the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, the trial not taking place because it's unconstitutional. Yada yada. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we talk about. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks.
All right, so it's you've got tomorrow's show. The week after that's me again, right?
Yeah, we're gonna try to edit because when I interviewed you, it was a podcast that had no commercials and stuff like that. So we're gonna try to edit it down to just you and me talking, not current events because it wouldn't be current, right? Have your audience listen to the interview.
Sure. And then, of course, then the week after, that's going to be the brand new episode with all the breaking news on it, and you'll talk about that. It is the Downright Upright Show with Philip Anthony. It airs 5 p.m. on Saturdays right here on AM 950. Philip, as always, it's a pleasure chatting with you, my friend.
Oh, my God. I love your show, and I hope everyone enjoys the next couple of weeks. This is so exciting on my show. So thank you for having me and talking about it.
Well, thank you for coming on the air and talking with it about it, and all my best out there. Philip Anthony joining us once again, the Downright Upright Show. And one of the things I just love about Philip Anthony, this is quality stuff. I mean, it's, you know, he is every week on a Saturday. You want great programming, listen on AM 950 throughout the weekend. We have great programming all weekend long. I mean, right after his show is Wall of Power with Metza. You can't beat it, man. Just quality stuff right here on AM 950. So, you know, turn your knob to AM 950, rip the knob off. There you go. All right. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. I do want to, I'll tell you what, I'll get into this story here really quick and give you a little synopsis and you can kind of see where it's going. And then I want to talk a little bit about this. It's not going to be dancing this week. You'll understand why. It's not going to be dancing necessarily this week, but I got some music to end up the week with on as well, coming up here in a little bit. Ever since David Lant took over as lead pastor of Mills Church in Minnetonka nearly 20 years ago, congregation and community members have reached out to him as a last resort when they couldn't pay their rent or mortgage. He's also seen the next generation of his congregation be priced out of the community they grew up in. They can't afford anything here, he said. Lant took these pleas from his congregation and considered that his church owned a big dinosaur of a building, a giant parking lot that never filled up, and a total of 5.5 acres of mostly unused land that could be used to house community members in need. The church, with the help of Habitat for Humanity, hopes to build up to 10 homes, 5 sets of twin homes, similar to townhomes, to sell to low-income families through Habitat for Humanity's home financing and subsidy programs. Now, just one quick thing here. Habitat for Humanity, this is the group that these people are helping to build this house on. It's a fantastic, Habitat for Humanity is such an amazing program. And it, you know, the sweat equity that you have to put in to be considered for these places, you get a lot here. I want to be very clear here. This is Habitat for Humanity stuff. This is not just some sort of, it's a big handout. No, they have to go help build their homes. I've worked on Habitat for Humanity homes. I've seen the people out there upset when everyone else is leaving because they want to, because it's their home and they want to get it built. And so they want people to stay as long as they can. Habitat for Humanity is a fantastic organization. And this church stepping up and saying, you know, hey, let's make sure we get some people with affordable housing. Yeah, I think that that's a good thing. And I'm just going to say it's Minnetonka, so we already know where this is going. All right? We already know where this is going. But it's not necessarily anything unique to Minnetonka. It's something that we see everywhere. We have people, a lot of people who love the idea of low-income housing. But yet, when it comes to saying, okay, we're going to build some over here, a block from your house. Not in my neighborhood! And that is the failure of us as a society. I'll talk more about this when I do come back. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. I want to dance with my baby. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Okay, everyone, want a quick little laugh here? Lauren Boebert has been floated by GOP colleague as someone who could do a better job than Mike Johnson. Oh, she'll grab onto that legislation and she'll, she's going to put it in its place. Wrestle that. Get her. Come here, you. Beetlejuice, 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 you say. Oh, God. Sure. No, do it. Seriously, please. No, sweet Jesus, please. No, sweet Lord, please do that. That will show the Democrats. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205 is the phone number. So, once again, this is... What I am discussing is not something new. As a matter of fact, Betsy Hodges, when she was the mayor of Minneapolis, used to say, you will go talk to and let's call it out as it is, Democrats and progressives. And you'll say, hey, we want to get low-income housing. And they'll say, great. And they'll say, hey, we want to put it in your neighborhood. And said, never, not on my watch, because that NIMBY, not in my backyard stuff, kicks in. It's not, you know, this story is in Minnetonka. And I know exactly, here's the crazy part. I know exactly where this is at because it's right by where my kids went to junior high. It's right by Minnetonka Boulevard, right off there. It's, you know, at is it Plymouth Road there? That is, it's so just to the east of 494. It's a great idea because I can tell you, I mean, there is some low income housing in these wealthy suburbs. Not a lot. And I mean, and it's hard how you call low income housing, because you build a duplex in Minneapolis, yeah, it's probably going to be affordable housing. You build a duplex out in Wayzata or Minnetonka or Edina, you're still looking at a $400,000 duplex, shared wall, because you're the prestige of the neighborhood. Which is part of the problem, because you want to have a variety of options there. You know, it's this idea of, I mean, back in the 70s, I think it was the five county metro district at that point said that all the communities had to build some low income housing. And they said, you know, but you could basically go on out and pay a neighboring community to build some buildings for you. It's one of the reasons why Hopkins actually had a lot more low income housing than other communities, is because the other communities were paying Hopkins to build it for them. Well, you know, you can go over there and do it there. Well, they eventually stopped that, and they said, no, you have to have lower-income housing. And I know a lot of places try, and the way that they do it now is they'll build an apartment complex, and within the apartment complex, allegedly, and I'm going to repeat this, allegedly, there are, out of the 150 units, there's 30 units which are designed to be sold to people of lower-income status. I know that that's the idea. I've also known a lot of those apartments end up going to people who are not lower income status, and in a lot of cases are being used for like Airbnbs and stuff like that. So it's got mixed results, to say the least. It's not a bad concept, but what you do is you kind of, it's hiding the lower income housing in plain sight. It's part of this building which has got a lot of higher income housing, but it's right there. And most communities seem to be okay with that. But when you talk about, I'm going to dedicate these houses, I'm going to have Habitat for Humanity come in, we're going to build these houses, people are going to have sweat equity, they're going to put the money, their time and effort into helping to build these, and we're going to get these houses built, and boom, help out people that live and work here, want to live here, but do work here, and they're going to have affordable housing. And as it goes, it's going to go as exactly as you think. Repeating what I said there, the church, with the help of the Habitat for Humanity, hopes to build up to 10 homes, 5 sets of twin houses, similar to townhouses, to sell to lower-income families through Habitat for Humanity. But Lance and other advocates for affordable housing in Minnetonka have repeatedly faced pushback from the city staff, elected officials, and neighbors who oppose the construction of multifamily housing on the church site. Go build that someplace else. Go shoo, 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 shoo. And hey, you don't want me using a Dyna Guy voice from Minnetonka? Oh, maybe you should, yeah. And by the way, this is, and I don't know if you've heard the part about the church. This is what the church does. Gospel of Matthew, making sure, you know, people are homeless, get them someplace inside. This is basic Christian teaching. But they didn't mean it in my neighborhood. And by the way, before anyone comes to me and says, well, Matt, well then, you can have lower income neighbor houses in your neighborhood. There are. Okay, I'm going to talk you off the ledge right now. There are. Block and a half from my house are lower income housing. I've never had any problem in my neighborhood. My house is worth a heck of a lot more than when I bought it. They're great neighbors. We have them. The neighborhood does an annual picnic. We do an ice cream social. They're out there. We're part of the community. It's wonderful. Ta-da! This is one of the reasons why I don't have a lot of tolerance for this, is because I'm living what we're supposed to do and not shying away from it. And I think it's wonderful. I think it works like a charm. The proposal does not conform to the city's comprehensive plan because it's too dense. In order to move forward, the city council must change the comprehensive plan to allow more density, and the council takes cues from the city planners working on the project. A recent no recommendation from the city staff blindsided Lant and Chris Coleman, the former mayor of St. Paul, who is now the president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity Twin Cities. The developer of the project, they say meetings with the city staff in which the developers reduced the number of units and adjusted the aesthetic of the projects left the impression the city staff would support the revised project. Okay, because but you see, it's not about density. Okay, come on, man. Well, it clearly isn't. If they still have a problem and you guys reduce the number of units, well, it's not density that's the problem, is it? City staff had consistently told Lant and Habitat for Humanity that the project does not conform to the comprehensive plan, said Julie Wishnack, community development director of the city of Minnetonka. We went into this thinking that we had the support, we had the dedication of the comp plan, we're asking for a pretty moderate development. Coleman said this is not a 3,000-unit subdivision. On Thursday night, the Minnetonka Planning Commission voted to uphold the staff recommendation. The city council will ultimately decide on May 6th whether to change the comprehensive plan and zoning guidelines to allow the proposal to proceed and whether to send it back to the drawing board. Coleman and Lance say the fight to build less than a dozen homes is an example of how local governments use comprehensive plans and zoning rules to thwart new developments in Minnesota as the state faces a massive shortage of housing of all types. I don't think I am out of line that if some guy bought that lot of land and built the most obnoxious looking McMansion you've ever seen, just one of those. What, you've seen the black ones? What are you doing, man? Sure thing, Morticia. No, I mean, it looks horrible. Some just one of those things. It's like the house after, you know, after they remodeled it in Beetlejuice. Just looks god awful. But because it's who bought it. Do you see who's buying the land? Well, that one can go through, no problem. I don't think that that would be an issue. I don't think Minnetonka would have an issue with that, even though it would be an eyesore right next to the Burwell House, which is their historic house there on Minnetonka Boulevard. I don't think they'd have a problem with it. But 10 units for lower-income housing? That's a bridge too far. And if we could raise the bridge, maybe. I know, I added that part, but no. You get my point. I get tired of this crap. The local conflict has reached the halls of the Capitol, where Lant Coleman and Minnetonka City Council member Kimberly Wilburn have lobbied in favor of legislation that would restrict cities' ability to block new housing developments. The bill, which would have limited municipality options for controlling new housing development sizes and aesthetics, was sidelined earlier this year as it failed to get enough support. In an editorial published in the Star Tribune, Minnetonka Mayor Brad Wiersum joined other suburban mayors in advocating against the zoning bills. As we contemplate solutions to Minnesota's housing challenges, we must prioritize strategies that balance promoting development and preserving the unique character for our communities, the mayor wrote. This requires a nuanced approach that empowers local governments to make informed decisions tailored to the specific circumstances rather than imposing one-size-fits-all mandates for the state level. Now, I'm going to be very clear. I am personally against the idea of the state regulating this because I do think you have to have some ability by the local community to make the thing. But the problem that you don't seem to be having to understand is that all your lower income housing can't be on the underpass under 394, Mayor. Okay? You can't put the lower income housing over in the derelict industrial park where no one can see it. Down in some flooded ravine that you drained off, but if it gets an inch of rain, it all floods back up again. You can't just put it there. And this is not, in reality, a bridge too far in any capacity. It doesn't sound like it in any capacity. But yet, once again, here we are with the NIMBY crap. And I understand you guys are going to get so upset with me because that's not what this is. Is it? Is it? Because it doesn't sound like a bunch of people who are willing to come out there and help build their own homes so they can have the pride and luxury of having their own place to live, helped with by the church, is some grand sacrifice. And considering my kids go to school right down the street from you at Hopkins High School, I've seen tons of other developments you guys have built in that city. Senior housing, all the renovations you're doing over by Ridgedale and all these things. And sure, some of it looks nice, some of it doesn't. But telling people was like, well, we'll build lower income housing as long as it's in the old oil pit over at the Firestone outside of Ridgedale so no one can ever see it. And a cop is parked outside of it the entire time. Well, it's not exactly the welcome sign, is it? For 20 plus years, I've lived in this district. I've lived around these people. It's like Mayor Hodges said. I love the idea. They love the idea of lower income housing, just nowhere near them. How dare you build anything but a house that's going to increase the value of my house? Well, your house is not going to get devalued. It's 10 homes, for God's sakes. You make it sound like a terrorist group is going to move in. Not necessarily in this case, but that's when you get these arguments against this, that's what they say. They're like, oh, well, you're going to get those people in here now. There's going to be cars. And trust me, I was on planning and zoning in Hopkins for many years, and it was the same thing. I'd run into this all the time. We can't have this here. You know what's going to happen next. Growth, affordability, a happy community? What? It's hiding. I mean, we all know what's going on here. Sure, you're hiding around density and rules, and it's not pretty enough. There needs to be more shrubs, so we're going to deny it, whatever the case may be. We all know what's going on here. And you see, is the reason why all of a sudden this bill now got introduced at the Capitol is you guys are getting really bad at this. And like I said, if it's some 300-unit apartment and 20 of the units are for lower-income people, you guys, that's kind of the new model. That's what you're seeing a lot of. But if it's actual houses where people might have a yard or something like that, they can be seen. That's when all of a sudden, well, we got problems with the zoning code and the density. How are you wanting us to do this? You guys change that damn thing. Most cities change the rules when they want something built with no problem, without batting an eye. Most cities do that. It's frustrating because I see a church that has a really good heart on it that's trying to do the right thing. In an incredibly unaffordable community, which is something the community likes, by the way, being very unaffordable for certain people. Basically, trying to fulfill a need there, and even after they'd made adjustments for the city's like, oh, we know what's going to happen here. You live in a city. You've chose to live in a city. This isn't some small town where you have bought a plot of land, on the outskirts of the city where you have 20 acres and you built your house and you got this. And it's like you're not expecting all of a sudden to be an apartment complex right next door to you. This is you live in the city. And what we've got is a lot of people that, and don't get me wrong, I think that some cities do get a little too loosey-goosey with approving everything. I'm not going to point out any cities in particular. But there are some cities, I think, that do get a little bit loosey-goosey, that you should have some standards. But at the same time, we also have a lot of cities that basically are like, well, oh, it's a McMansion? A multimillionaire wants to buy the land? Well, where do we approve that, even though it goes against our code and zoning laws? That's a go. Oh, it's lower-income people. Oh, well, I'm sorry. Here's our lengthy list of I'm sorry, you can't possibly make all these, and we're going to have to turn it down. Sure, fine. I'll go with Minnetonka's argument. It's the density issue. But I don't think anyone is really buying that as the real issue here. The area is currently zoned up to 4 housing units per acre. The current proposal of 10 twin homes whittled down from the initial plan of 12, put the development at 4.6 per acre, which is a 0.6 unit. Oh, my God! If they do 0.6, you know what's next? Gangs running Minnetonka. Yeah, okay, whatever. Ugh. And once again, this is a church doing it. This isn't some. This is a church out there just saying, "Hey, let's try to be decent people." Nope. The developers would solve the density issue by reducing the number of units or by incorporating the more available land to the project. Wishnack said Mills Church is offering 2.2 acres of its land to a deep discount to Habitat Humanity for the project and isn't interested in adding more land to the deal simply because the city won't adjust the zoning from low to medium density. Every time it's like, do less, give more, do less, give more, do less, give more, and we just think that's ridiculous, Lance said. You've got a good project. I mean, adding more land doesn't change the project at all. It's still five twin homes. This is only the latest. And once again, Minnetonka, you are by no means the only city that does this. You're not the only one. Heaven forbid you build those houses in our prestigious virgin, you know, neighborhoods. No, no, no. We're going to put you over by the Quickie Mart and the Jiffy Lube and the Kentucky Fried Chicken. That's where the low-income housing goes. Or else, and by the way, in Minnetonka, I can say this about Minnetonka, Minnetonka is really good at hiding their poor people or poorer people. Because once again, still to buy a townhome, a shared wall, is pretty pricey in Minnetonka. But they hide them. You would not believe the nooks and crannies. And they're not by no means the only community that does this. But they go out of their way to make sure anything that would be perceived as lower income housing is not to be seen. The Buster Bluth mentality of housing. And there are, because my kids have friends. And I was like, I didn't even realize there was a neighborhood back in here. Wow. It's hidden right by the highway. So it's not exactly the pristine land anyway. I don't know what you do here. It's not a good look. And once again, for all the people out there, like, well, but Matt, if it was your house, I've got lower income housing near my house. I don't care. I've never had a problem. It's fine. People need someplace to live. I am not so controlled by the false rainbows of the money I'm going to make off my property to basically bleed out what my heart tells me is the right thing to do. How about that? How about I say it like that? I'm not going to sit there and say, well, if we get, I've got right now in my neighborhood, I've got a really eclectic neighborhood. Some of my neighbors, they're fairly financially successful. Some of my neighbors aren't. But I've got a wide variety, and they're still neighbors. I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem. The biggest problem I had in the last 15 years is when they were rebuilding 169, and the wealthy people were trying to get to their neighborhoods, come screaming up my streets, because once again, when they put out those signs that say, drive like your kids live here. Well, I always find that to be one of the most hypocritical things because those people never drive like their kids live anywhere else. So it's basically about you're a heathen person, drive safely. You know, that sort of thing. I got in a good neighborhood. It's got lower income housing in it. I have no problem with it. I don't know why 10 houses is such a bridge too far. But like I said, I have zero doubt in my mind, just having seen how Minnetonka has done things the last 20 years, that this could be the most god-awful pink-purple rainbow McMansion monstrosity that you've ever seen. The Barbie house on steroids. But if it was a wealthy enough guy, they would make every accommodation that they could to make sure the zoning laws accommodated them. Because I've seen that kind of thing in Minnetonka. But 10 houses for lower-income people, all of a sudden, well, these are rigid rules we can't violate. Sure. Sure. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I got some music for you to take out on the weekend when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. And it was my mind. I was twisted, I was
over. Greg Bakken here. Like you, I love good, fresh, delicious food. So I want to tell you about this treasure in Roseville called Maverick's Real Roast Beef.
and I get it. Do you feel as if, well, I mean, is it really that big of a thing? Well, kind of it is. I don't know. There's a lot of really good people in Minnetonka. There's a lot of really good people in Minnetonka. And it's unfortunate that this is such a, you know, the bridge they basically decided, nope, we're not going to do this. Because there's a lot of good people on the other side, too. The lower income people that want a place to live, the church whose heart's in the right place and donating the land, and a lot of volunteers who are willing to come out there and show what community really means. And my guess is that Minnetonka's never going to allow it to happen. But there's an abandoned McDonald's that you guys can live behind there. That's lower income housing area. We'll even change the zoning code for you. Yeah, that's what I kind of guess. How about Taylor Swift? Why not? Taylor Swift and Post Malone. This is off the new album. It's called Fortnite. This takes us out this week. Have a good one. I will be back on a Monday. Till then, see ya.